is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And good afternoon, everybody. This is the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And hey, we have no guest today. We're going to do what we like to do the most, is pat ourselves on the back and try to throw out our shoulder. This is our fourth anniversary. Believe it or not, we have been doing this for 4 years, going on fifth. I think if you wanted to be a nitinoy about it, last week was probably the exact fourth, but we had a guest that worked better there. So we're going to shift it to the right week because it's our show, and we can do what we want to. So, hey, Eagle One, happy anniversary.
Well, thank you, Sal, and happy anniversary to you. Hello.
Well, thank you very much.
Are you still there?
I think we've laughed longer than many.
To be technically correct.
Yeah, technically
we've
correct.
We've had 42. We've had 42 best of shows.
Well, every show is a best of.
You still there? Of course. But, I mean, we're only 3.5 years worth of real shows.
Well, it all depends about how you define real. Live or Memorex, it doesn't really matter. But
there you go.
It's been fun. It's amazing. We've lasted, you know, about as long as most Navy marriages. Doing all right. We're doing just fine. I think what's kind of neat, and by the way, for those that are joining us live, if you haven't already, scroll down to the bottom of the page if you're so interested, and hop into the chat room. And if you have some questions for us, we're going to go all over the place today. That's a great place to go ahead and put it in there. We'll respond in real time. Or if you get over your stage fright and you want to call in, you can call us the switchboard at 347-308-8397, 347-308-8397. We're live and going without a net. So give us a call if you wanted to throw something our way, if there was a topic you wish we had covered. Or if you just wanted to ask Eagle One who invented liquid soap or why, we'll even take that question. It makes no difference. I figured you've been around long enough. So. If Eagle One is still there. One thing I did want to, and I mentioned this in the pre-show.
You know, it's that mute button.
That's what I thought it was. Yeah, they have no
place. It's giving me problems again.
Yeah, if you press your mute button for more than 4 hours, please go see a doctor. But
it's a two-position switch, and I keep it in the wrong position.
One thing I wanted to share with everybody, it's a speech that for our listeners who have been guests, they've heard before. But in the pre-show, we usually call our guests about 5 to 10 minutes, sometimes 2 minutes, before the show, and just to make sure we have a good connection, and we go over the ground rules and kind of set the scene. And one thing I like to outline for them is the format that we've developed. When we first started this, we tried to book 3 guests a show in 20-minute segments, and we thought that was pretty generous because when you think about it, a lot of times when you see an interview with somebody on a Talking Head show, you know, one segment is 6 minutes. If they're lucky, you get two up for 12 minutes. And so we say, hey, we'll be real generous and do it at 20. But what we found real fast is we just got warmed up at 20 minutes. So then we went to 2 guests, and then we said, you know what, let's just do it for the full hour. And without any hard breaks or without any soft breaks, one thing we like to tell our guests is to take all the time that they want to answer a question. And if they didn't like the question we asked, feel free to answer a different one. And if we liked our question too much, we might add I might ask it twice. And we've had a couple of guests who didn't take us up on that, and we almost ran out of questions a few times. But without even using names, I think, Eagle One, we've had a few of our guests, too, that I think you and I got maybe 2 out of 60 minutes in.
Yeah, some of them have been more they swear when they start – when we do the pre-interview that they don't think they have an hour worth of material. And some of their questions will take an hour, it seems, to answer, for them to answer. So it's been interesting.
Yeah, it's and we always kind of joke, because usually after the show when everybody hangs up, we'll talk amongst ourselves in private just as a wrap-up and kind of a lessons learned situation. And we do see on a regular basis that we have guests come on that are the hesitancy, especially in the pre-show, you can kind of see they're a little cautious, kind of wondering whether they should have said yes or not, or they're going to beat their publicist for agreeing to it. But they warm up halfway through the show. And I guess that's one thing, too. You know, Eagle One, I know the kids over at SimSec, they do a little bit of a podcast. There are a couple people do as well. And I think they've picked up on it as well. Is in smash mouth opinion world that, you know, blogs and online publications can be, and of course, you know, talk radio is, and the 24-hour news cycle can make, you know, interviews be that way as well, is we've always tried to have, I think the phrase we use is, you know, three guys sitting around a table having a beer and chatting. And that kind of a non-confrontational, we're not here to make news, we're here to see what you have to think. I think that more than anything else, and some of the feedback I've gotten, has been why we see that transition, is it's kind of a relief, especially for some of our guests. I think of Don Rumsfeld, when we had him on, that used to people who were either sycophantic, if that's actually a word, or a little bit too confrontational, and it wasn't like that. And I think people can agree or disagree with Don Rumsfeld, and I'm looking forward to the documentary coming up of his known unknowns, those that may have seen the previews. But I think for what we're trying to accomplish here on the show, Eagle One, that type of conversation tone, I think works really well, and I think it's a net benefit. I think we've had some good conversations here that have given people an opportunity to flesh out their ideas more than they have in other venues, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that only once or twice that I recall we've had somebody come on and we ask them, we want them to expand on their answers. We want them to feel free to give us the full broadside of their thought process, and we'll get that cryptic yep, nope, you know? And all of a sudden we realize that you're going to have to work for the show rather than the ones where we just kind of toss a question out and the guest has to labor along with it.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when you look at the people we've had on board. We've had a few active duty people on. We've had quite a few authors, because I think we're both book geeks, and I'll just speak for myself here. I don't think you'll disagree with me too much, but I'm a big advocate that, at least in this line of work, the more well-read you are, not necessarily technical type of stuff, but a broad reach of reading is good, because you get a chance to put your noggin in the brain of people that have either a different point of view or perhaps smarter than you are. But we've had professors on from, you know, civilian institutions and war colleges, a few academics, and guys from the think tanks. And this was a couple of years ago, but we had one guest on that I think ran out of talking points rather fast. And that's when I think it was a good demonstration about the different flavors of think tanks. And we've talked about it obliquely a few times. There are think tanks that really are think tanks. And there are think tanks that are mercenary advocate groups. And I think you always have to be careful when you look at people's byline, who's paying their paycheck. But I think those guys are good to have on as well, because I think they realize after about 15, 20 minutes that the next 45 minutes they got to find something besides talking points to work on.
Yeah, I think Sam from Istanbul has a pretty good question about were there guests we wanted to have in the show and were not able to convince them to participate. And I think the answer to that is yes, although we rarely had anybody just outright reject us, at least not that I'm aware of. But we do have people who say they will get back to us, and oftentimes even after we ping on them a little bit to get back to us, we don't hear from them again.
Yeah, we've had I've had at the most two people that have told me outright, no, I'm not interested in coming on. I don't want to come on. Actually, that's kind of refreshing. You know, neither one really expanded on why they did not want to come on. But yeah, after doing a little search, I realized they really don't do interviews at all. But we do get some that do that little two-step, and I think, you know, it's a pro note to people out there who are in the idea business. If you do get an invitation to come on, there's nothing wrong with just saying no, I'm not interested. Don't have to hem and haw. It's not going to hurt our feelings any. I think that people try to be polite in that respect and just wind up playing hard to get. It's always a lot easier if people just say, hey, listen, I'm just not interested in coming on. Thank you very much. And that saves everybody mighty trouble. But I haven't had anybody who has really, and I've been surprised some of the people that have said yes. But I think most of the people that we ask to come on are experienced in the marketplace of ideas. I know some of them have come on expecting a fight for whatever reason and haven't gotten it, who have been great guests and repeat guests. And that's one thing I'm also really proud of, is we have quite a few repeat guests who keep coming on. But, Sim, no, most people we ask do try to come on, and that's nice. And if anybody ever balks, there have been a couple of the guests we've had which were playing hard to get, is what I'll usually do is I'll try to find the one degree of separation from one of our prior guests, and I'll ask our prior guests to drop them an email to let them know what their experience is. And then those that were playing a little bit hard to get eventually say, yeah, we'll come on. I don't know. What do you think, Eagle One? The fact that it's a live show, now that I think about it, the fact that we're a live show from 5 to 6, I can count on one hand the amount of people that were interested in coming on, one of which is a very high-profile person. And this was actually disappointing to me. And I was talking to one of their admin types when they found out it was a live show and that we would not supply them ahead of time with questions, that they refused to come on. I was very disappointed because the individual, and I'm not going to out him because I'm actually a fan of theirs anyway. I was really surprised that individual was like that. And I look at all the interviews and stuff he does since then, looking through that lens, but it was very, very disappointing. So yeah, there are some, as you can tell, I try to accentuate the positive, believe it or not, that have said, oh, it's live and you're not going to tell me what the questions are ahead. I mean, Eagle One, you know, help a brother out here, but I think you and I laugh about it. It's like, I have no idea what I'm going to ask. You just kind of roll with it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing, that it is a live show, and the interview, the questions we ask the interviewees, I mean, I don't think either of us were professional interviewers when we started this, and we're certainly not, since we don't get paid, we're still not professionals. But, you know, we do ask the basic questions that any journalist would ask, which is who, what, when, where, you know, how did you get interested, you know, the kind of questions that are open-ended enough to allow the person to talk about what it is they're up to or why they think whatever they're talking about is important, which, you know, and I think we're relatively courteous. I don't think we've ever slammed a guest, even if we thought the guest was not necessarily traipsing down the path of truth and light, but, you know, I mean, we get a lot of feedback in the chat room when a guest wanders too far afield. But I think for the most part, if anybody listens to the show before they decide whether or not to come on, and we always give them the chance, or that we always send them the link to make sure they know what we're about. I don't think they have anything to fear. We're not asking like, you know, are you still beating your wife question. So.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think that's the right way to do it. And just for the guys in the chat room, that's one thing I've never recommended any of our guests do is monitor the chat room during the show, because I love the guys in the chat room, but that's where the Stadler and Waldorf hang out is in the chat room. It's true. We got some smart listeners, smart guys in the chat room. And I've got your questions about anti-ship cruise missiles and LCS and reductions. Those are great questions. We'll get to those. I wanted to go to Navy Crick while we're being narcissists and talking about ourselves here in the first quarter of the show. He asked, and I don't know whether he's being sarcastic or if you mean it legitimate, well, thank you. But he asked, how you learn to interview well, it's a skill. Wow, I don't know if we're the best interviewers in the world because we can't find our mute button, and I can't shut up. First of all, I appreciate the compliment. If it is such, if you're being a smart ass, go Pack Sand. But I think the key is to keep it conversational. I have a smile on my face during the show because sometimes I'm impressed that these people have agreed to come talk to two of us. And without waxing your apple too much, O bearded one, you're a great person.
It's ancient, bearded one.
Because I really feel comfortable here sitting down with the show because I know that you're not going to go off the reservation and cut somebody head off. I'm not going to do that. And I think that makes the guests real comfortable. And I think if your guests are comfortable and you go in with a happy, interested attitude, this is going to make for an interesting show, and you're going to ask good questions. And it also helps the fact that Eagle One and I are the ones that booked the show. When you talk to people who actually do this for a living, they have producers who say, oh, by the way, you know, person X is coming on. And they're like, really? Really, Dennis Miller made an interesting comment once offline in that regard, that some of the guests that he comes on, if it was up to him, he wouldn't be booked. So I think also it's practice because we have been doing it 4 years. And I know part of being in the Navy, especially if you were a recidivist staff weenie like myself or like you, Eagle One, have a legal background, asking questions to try to pull out information is something that you do in your professional regard, so it translates well to the show, I think.
Yeah, and I think Claude points out that Brian Lamb, who I also think is a great interviewer, but I mean, I agree with Claude, he's a great interviewer. I'm not comparing either of us to Brian Lamb, but you know, preparation's a big part of it, and for the most part, we have been lucky enough to get the reading materials, the materials we would read asked a guest about in advance of the show. I think on only maybe one or two occasions we've even seen the book yet. But and I think both of us have made an effort to try and read, if not the, you know, given the time constraints we're under because we have other lives, to try and read the material and look at interesting things in it to ask the guest. Now, sometimes we get it completely wrong. There have been plenty of questions that I threw out, not because I knew the answer, but because I didn't know the answer, and you know, it was kind of a I get the question thrown right back at me, which is good. I mean, I'd rather have the guest say, no, you got that completely wrong, than to just kind of go, oh, well, you know, yeah, well, you could see that. But so that,
yeah, I got that. I had that happen to me a couple of weeks ago, and part of it is as I mangled my question. But I like when guests do that because another thing that we – you and I talk about amongst ourselves, we don't really tell our guests that. No, I think we've told a couple of guests that. There's another thing about the show is it is about the guests, and we want to give them an opportunity to tell their story. And I think that's pretty good for the guests that we have that say, yeah, you're wrong. And they rephrase our question for us and run off. But that's only happened a handful of times.
Well, a couple of them have done it more, some of them have done it more forcefully than others. I think we've had a couple of, you know who I'm talking about. I mean, he's a little more thorny than some of the other people we have dealt with. Good guest, though, but he can be a little abrupt in his responses. You know, and I think the other thing is that we're not mission driven in the sense of we've got some agenda we want to put out, although we do have a goal, which is to help solve the issue of sea blindness. I mean, this is a maritime and Navy related show, and we want to talk about the importance of sea power. Our guests are, if not always directly on point, have some connection with that issue, and I think that helps us too. We're not trying to impress anybody with an agenda driven thing. We do have an underlying purpose to the show, though.
You're exactly right, and I think that's why we've had quite a few shows that keep touching on the same subject, and it's for a reason. And especially a decade of mostly a land-focused war, that sea blindness is an issue. We've had some of our Canadians on. We've had Brits on because they have similar issues and similar cultures where they talk about it. And one thing that we've spent a fair bit of time on is the thoughts and the ideas about looking back to the Pacific and going back to Scott Brehm's question about the anti-ship missiles. And some of our guests, I know Barney Rubble brought this up most recently. And Admiral Lockyer said a few things in the last week that just gave me a migraine. But we have been so focused on other things. I was thinking today as I was walking my puppy. I have a new puppy. It's amazing what dogs can bring to your mind. That we've really been focused so much on programs, and platforms. I know that the CNO did the whole payloads over platforms discussion. But I really don't think that we've talked enough about the fact of we still don't talk enough about the payloads that to control the sea. Kind of when Barney was talking about when he was a Nugget A7 driver over in the Mediterranean, where all of a sudden they realized, holy crap, we have no ability to conduct war at sea unless I have to drop an iron bomb down somebody's throat, a la Argentina back in '82, and here we are. That we make a lot of assumptions that we just have to show up in presence. If you actually have to go after the porcupine, we're basically asking the fleet to do it with gloved hands, no sticks, much less a gun or anything. I know we're looking at finally getting something that is beyond late 20th century technology, but it would be nice to see more of that conversation come on in 2014. That was on my list of things I'm looking for at 2014, is projecting power from sea to sea. If you want to have command of the seas, you have to sweep it in front of you. And I love myself a Los Angeles and Virginia-class submarine, but there's only so many of them, and they can only do so much. And we have a surface fleet and an aviation fleet that I think is ill-suited to be able to efficiently sweep the seas unless every one of the planning assumptions are valid. We need more tools in our toolbox, and people are going in that right direction. So that's one of the things for 2014 that I'm going to keep an eye on, because it's a concern that I've been reading about since the 1990s. When we were looking at the former Soviet Union's capabilities with supersonic anti-ship cruise missiles. Other navies have ships we'd like to sink to, and I prefer not to ask our sailors to get within knife-fighting distance when we should have armed them with a gun to begin with.
Yeah, I think one of the other things that we touch on it, you do much more on your blog than you do on the show, but there are so many agendas affecting Navy operations and military operations in general. Many, in fact, most of which have nothing to do with strategy, tactics, equipping our fleet, equipping our personnel, training our personnel. They have all these other issues that society is forcing on the military. And I guess one of the things I look forward to as we go down the road is we need to find some people to talk to about how do we lessen the impact of that on our readiness and enhance the things that were really important to for the reason that we have a fleet in being. And I'm not sure I'm expressing that as clearly as I could, but I'm concerned about the sociological experiments going on with us that seem to be hindering rather than helping us be ready to execute our mission.
Yeah, it was nice with the new CNO came on board I usually don't mention people's name, but I'll mention it in this case, and most of the regulars here know I don't have, let me word this right, because I know he's a man that was doing what he thought was what he thought was best. I just think he's very wrong. He was very wrong. I think Admiral Ruffhead's tenure was a lost opportunity, let me put it that way. And I think CNO Greenert, who was a good loyal vice CNO, I know mutual friends of ours weren't too happy with him becoming the CNO, but it was nice for him to at least put out there warfighting first as a focus, just to set a theme. But you're right, there were a lot of distractions out there that really had nothing to do with ultimately what is the function of the Navy that the taxpayers are funding. And a lot of that has to do with being inside the D.C. bubble. I call it being of D.C. as opposed to in D.C. And that's why you people wonder why, you know, I think he's Vice Admiral now. Anyway, Vice Admiral Copeman with the SWOS survey. And people were surprised, you know, what, there's no pride in the Navy? Of course there's not a pride in the Navy. What do they see our senior leadership talking about? We're a bunch of spice-smoking, rapist homophobes. That's not the Navy that I know. That's not the Navy that you know. That's not the Navy that, I'll use his name because he loves when he gets attention, good JOs like Lieutenant Hipple that we had on as a guest. That's not the Navy that he sees either, but that's what's put out there because that is what they get pushed at in D.C. And I think we saw at the interview where they had that sexual assault survey come out, which, good gracious, a first year, not even a graduate student, somebody who's getting their undergrad in statistics could tell you that data set was garbage. The sample was garbage. But they passively nodded their head and say, oh, yes, we have an expanding epidemic of sexual assault, and, yes, my sailors are all raping each other, as opposed to standing up for their fleet. I think there's a difference between deference to the Congress, who holds the purse, and they have their own agendas, but there reaches a point that sailors hope that the Navy that they know and the Navy that they serve in is recognized and defended. And those distractions are D.C. distractions that people in D.C. decide that they need to say certain things and do certain things, but the Navy isn't in D.C. The Navy's in San Diego. The Navy's in Norfolk. It's in Mayport. It's in Bremerton. It's in Yokohama. It's sitting there dragging chains in 135-degree heat in the Arabian Sea in the middle of summer. And I think that's unfortunate, to say the least, that we don't have more people. You can do it politely. You can do it respectfully. But to decide, somebody just needs to make the call, you know what, I'm not going to be the CNO, or you know what, I'm happy to retire with 3 stars. I don't need a 4th star. And stand up for their sailors. And I think you want to improve people's pride in their Navy, defend them. Defend them against that smear.
Yeah, on the other hand, I mean, we have to, and you and I have discussed this, but we have to be really careful. There are people in positions of power who will abuse positions of power. Some people in positions of power will abuse positions of power, and other people who pursue people in power. I mean, everybody in the modern world will have their groupies at some point. But I can see how in the modern world we can create a situation where a CEO of a particular size unit can have a groupie that might pursue him, and it's got to be really, really careful about dealing with it. But on the other hand, it is the job of the commanding officers and the senior and all the officers in the service, for that matter, and the other leadership, the chiefs and the first class, and all that, to fight against that, and not to keep quiet about it at the deck plate level. It can't be one of these things where it only shows up at the point where this congressional and some CO has handed his walking papers. It should have been nipped in the bud long before it ever got to that point.
Yeah, I think another thing that we need to—I don't know how you really word this—but we're a human institution. We're full of humans, and humans will be human. And you're going to have some of those faults. I think it's best to make an example, though. For instance, the contracting and husbanding agents. As I don't know whether people still refer to them as husbanding agents, that was over Westpac. Anybody involved in that type of graft or corruption, or the trollish senior officer or commanding officer who all of a sudden finds that nubile 25-year-olds are really into old men, and they fall for that weakness, they should be made an example of. And that's always going to happen. You're not going to get rid of it. You could probably mitigate it simply, fear and shame. fear and shame are great motivators. And perhaps there's a little bit of fear that, I'm 52, and that 22-year-old E3 that just put her hand on my thigh in Suda Bay at 2 in the morning, maybe I need to leave, as opposed to letting things go where they go, which is sad. Powers and aphrodisiacs.
That's what Kissinger said, and the way he looked at me, he probably had to be.
Speaking of trolls.
the Lord didn't waste any time on his looks, but he sure did give him one heck of a brain. Let's answer a couple of questions. Talk about that ACM or ASM question that Scott. Do you answer Scott to the question about your. And for those of you who can't read the chat room, if I can scroll back up to it, are the anti-ship missiles the huge problem the small ship advocates say they are? Yes, is the answer. And the fact that they are becoming so ubiquitous. I mean, we are really in an interesting time, which, is not always a good thing. The ability of non-state organizations to acquire these things and put them in places where we actually would like to have a fleet presence poses real problems to all of us. I mean, to all of us connected with the maritime services. And the best example I think we've gone over a couple of times is the Hezbollah missiles in Beirut. A couple of years ago, when they managed to whack fortunately didn't do much damage, but whack an Israeli ship. And if that doesn't make your eyebrows, if you're a ship driver, that doesn't make your eyebrows go up and down. You're in the wrong business.
Yep, and I think it folded into another question that we had. What that does is that really requires. And let's don't even talk supersonic. Let's talk old school, from CA-02s to harpoons to exocets. Let's roll it off to you got something that's tooling around at 9 miles a minute. You're too close to shore. you better make sure somebody is in the middle of a heavy yawn because you're going to miss your window to take that out. And that means you need to move back from shore. And why you're sacrificing the ability to project power ashore in order to get close to shore with LCS is kind of counterintuitive. But the closer you get to shore, the more threat you're going to have, and the anti-ship cruise missile just makes that even further away. Now, it used to be one of my greatest critiques about LCS is you want to have something the size of a World War II destroyer come close to shore, then Amir with his 23-millimeter anti-aircraft gun in the back of a Toyota pickup truck is going to see you come in the bay, and it's going to light you up, and it's going to cut right through that pretty aluminum like you read about. Now it's, oh, you're hanging offshore, and you know he's got his two cousins with their just inside a cell phone range in their skiff, reporting your GPS coordinates, so they can back it out of the shed and pop a CA-02 your direction. Yeah, you're going to be close. That's going to be an interesting thing to see. And I can't remember where I read it online, and I don't know whether we're really right there, but I think we're probably within 5 years. Because I kind of went, Because one thing that makes military technology so expensive and so heavy is it's built mil-spec. It's built sturdy. It's built to be able to put into storage for long periods of time. With minimal maintenance, then, you know, break the seal, plug it in, get your green lights, press your button, is there's a lot of, and I know it's an irritating phrase, but I want to use it in an appropriate menu. There's lots of disruptive technology out there. For instance, the 3D printing. Eventually, it's going to reach the point that you're going to be able to 3D print in the right materials that you can print the difficult components that it takes to make a very primitive, short-range but effective anti-ship cruise missile that you can put, if you can follow an IKEA set of directions, you'll be able to put something together that you can put in some numbers. It won't last long. It's not going to be too fancy. It's not going to be too sexy. It's not going to be too fast. But if you have enough kerosene and you can get the parts together, you can quite effectively build a something that makes you need to back off a bit just to be able to be a little safer, so to speak. So that's my feeling about the anti-ship cruise missile. You combine the time distance challenge with even the robust ones are being sold to a lot of places, to the ability to create some homegrown stuff here probably in the next decade that's going to make the challenge even greater. That's going to mean we need to be able to sit off back from shore and then be able to project power from there, which I guess is another issue. If you have to do that, unless you got a carrier standing off there, what do we have to project power ashore?
That long pause was brought to you by...
McDonnell Douglas.
Before I answer that question, attempt to answer that question, let me throw one more thing into the hopper. There's a really good book. If you haven't read it, it's about drones. It's called, I can't remember what it's called, Wired something. But the point is that drones are also becoming ubiquitous. There's no reason that I can't put together. In fact, I've got a couple of little helicopters my sons gave me for Father's Day that have cameras in them and stuff. I can send those things up and take all kinds of pictures. There's nothing that prevents any semi-competent model aircraft maker, and that could be anybody because it'd take anything to make those things, from putting a TV camera on a remote control plane, send it out and to some substantial distance and be able to spot what's over the horizon. The world is a lot more complicated. Wired for War is the name of the book. The world is a lot more complicated now than it was than back in the good old days when I was worried about the Russian Navy and their Akrano planes popping up over the horizon. These are complex issues, and I'm sure every day somebody in the Navy is losing sleep over, well, what do we do if, at least I hope they are. I hope they're losing sleep over those questions.
Well, that's why the question we had in the chat room, and I'm sorry, I forgot who asked it, about the decrease in the buy down to OJ's number of 32 for LCS. I think 24 would be wonderful, but we'll take 32. And the question is, how much of that extra money that's left over is just going to be taken for savings? How much is going to be thrown into our good friend Captain Mark Vandruff's DDG 51 program? Or how much of that is going to be used to help develop and field the next generation anti-ship cruise missile would be nice, but also to help build some of our systems to be able to address just what you're talking about. I love to duck hunt. I would love to have my own private drone that I could send out over the marsh to tell me where which potholes the ducks are using. It sounds like a joke, but I guarantee you there's some bubba in Louisiana that's almost about to do it if they're not doing it already. And that is something we can't wish away. And there are some smart people, like you said, I hope, that are really looking at that, because there are things we need to concentrate on. And that's one of them. Another thing is kind of a soft power, and I almost wanted to bring this subject up when we had Admiral Kirby on the second time, but I thought it might put him on report too much. But one thing that concerns me a bit when we're dealing with China is nobody in that part of the world, the Japanese, the Korean, the Chinese, the Vietnamese, the Filipinos, Malaysians, Indonesians, none of them really have a reason to be friends with the Chinese. They have a couple thousand years of dealing with the Chinese. The Chinese tend to be, we're the big emperor, you're the little emperor attitude. But there's a lot of reasons for those countries to want to maintain friendly relations with us. But that is a face culture. And there's a lot of things that are being said for purposes inside of D.C. of getting more funding about how we're weak. I don't know if we can really project power out in the West. And these are four stars who are saying these types of things that really play into the Chinese PSYOPs campaign. That, hey, neighbors, be careful how much you utilize the U.S. because even if they were your friend, they may not be too much use to you because look what they're saying about their own power. I don't think we're doing a very good PSYOPs and InfoOps program against the Chinese. I think they are running circles around us simply because we're kind of playing into their game and talking in a Western context. Vice talking in a Eastern context. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I'm not sure. I think the Navy has this will say a lot about the program. We're supposed to have these foreign area experts, like the Army does. What I don't remember what they are. The FAOs in the Navy. I can't remember what. And they're supposed to be. We're supposed to have people who really understand what we should be doing to just what you said, to maintain our face, to make sure that we're not giving the wrong message out there. And I'm not sure that I've seen anything that addresses that. We've got some great stuff coming out of the Naval War College on China. They have a special group up there that kind of focuses on stuff, and we've certainly interviewed the heck out of a lot of those people. But I don't recall face and the full meaning of that in the cultures that you described has been a topic of discussion. But that really ought to be something that we're focused on, and it doesn't have to be and may not be appreciated if we do breast beating. Well, we're still number one, we could beat anybody we want to, but it's got to be done in the right way. And I would hope that if we have a group of officers who are specifically assigned to be experts in that part of the world, that they could are being listened to about how to properly and if they haven't been listened to yet, be brought in about how to properly address these issues.
Well, I mean, you brought up an important point, is who do we have in the China shop? And I've had a few people who think we have the wrong people in the China shop. And I think you can see some of that reflected in Admiral Locklear's statement recently, where he said, and I'm going to quote him, the PACOM goal is for China to be a net provider of security, not a net user of security, unquote. Well, besides the fact that that's just a horrible way to describe it, I think we need to be very honest and upfront about what China is and the direction they're coming from. And we've had some great guests on from the Naval War College, especially, that are smart on China. And I don't think that those views are the ones that are getting the ears to create things like that. The Chinese are returning from a few hundred years of losing face, of shame, and of weakness. They've got huge chips on their shoulders. They've got lots of scores to settle. They have a demographic implosion taking place, huge ecological problems, economic problems, resource access problems. They're not interested in being the Belgian frigate in our little operations group. They're not interested in hanging out in Strasbourg with the European Parliament and talking about nice, pleasant things. They're a serious country with serious problems. The Chinese don't play. But there is a group of thought that thinks that we can be friends with China, we can be partners with China, we can make China be another France, or make China another Italy or another Turkey. I think that's foolish. And it's one thing to say it, but I there are people in our China shop advising our leaders who actually believe that. So it'd be nice to have some of our friends at the War College be invited to perhaps influence a little more. And I think it's okay to be polite and nice, but I think our senior leadership, without being completely bloody-minded about it, also needs to be very clear about the fact that we are more than happy to protect our interests in the Pacific against any impolite nature. And I don't think enough of that conversation comes on. I don't think it'll be inflammatory. I think what it will is it will tell Vietnam, the Philippines, Korea, and Japan that, hey, this, you know, the 21st century, the Pacific isn't going to be the American lake, but we're your partner. We're here. Don't be bullied. And I don't think statements such as that show a China that doesn't exist helps those nations we'd like to be partnered with to have them feel that we're serious. That's my take.
Yeah, I agree, and I'm you know, so much of it depends on, and this, you and I both had a so much depends on the quality of leadership and their ability to believe in the mission that they're being assigned, and that starts at the very, very top. And you and I both had a blog post recently that kind of hit on that issue with respect to former Secretary of Defense Gates. And, you know, the willingness of people to say what they mean sometimes when they actually mean what they are going to say, I think is really important. And I'm not sure that's being done at the highest levels, but, or if it's being done at the highest levels, what that level believes to be the state of the world is not necessarily how the rest of us might view it. Now, some of that, as you were talking, I'm sitting there thinking, you know, the standard Navy officer approach to most things is what's the worst case scenario? You start off, at least people I know, you start off with the issue of what's the worst case here, and then you begin to back off that to see what you're, as you work through your decision trees of where you can go and what you can do. But, you know, most of us were trained to start off with what's the worst case. And I often wonder if you and I in our discussions are thinking too much in that vein, and we're not, you know, you just kind of discounted the people who say, well, these people think it's going to be, you know, can be sweetest and light. Well, you know, they may be right unless, but have they taken into consideration what the worst case is? And they don't. They want it to be sweetness and light. And, you know, the job of the military is the opposite of that. Is you have to assume it's not going to be and go from there. So I'm interested in how this will play out.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair critique, and that's one of the neat things that when you get involved in long-range planning or even training for operations at the operational level, especially when you bring in NGOs, IOs, things like the Red Cross, things like USAID. To give that different perspective, because you're right, and a lot of the military mind is, okay, what's the worst thing these people can do? How do I counter that? Okay, if they don't do that, well, that's great. Then fewer people get killed. But the opposite, I think, is even more dangerous, which those that, you have the most dangerous and the most likely COA, and their most likely COA is everybody does a reprieve of the Coca-Cola commercial from the 70s, and you plan for that, you resource for that, you train for that, and then lo and behold, you find yourself like Poland with a German pre-dreadnought in your own port bombing your facilities. And I think with China, and you've on a couple of our shows, I mean, you've heard this, I'm a believer that they're going to get old before they get rich. They are more focused on keeping their people content than they are invading any of their neighbors. But I also know the Chinese are insecure. They feel they've got some, and they are legitimate grudges against their neighbors and the rest of the world. That type of insecurity and chip on your shoulders can make people do stupid things. So you need to be prepared for the bad portions of that. And part of what will mitigate that from the Chinese doing something stupid is that they feel there's no weakness. And their neighbors are willing to not be bullied because they feel strong, because they have a good backup. So sometimes by being too nice, are playing into other people, your concern of hurting people's feelings too much, you can create the opposite of a self-fulfilling prophecy. You can create exactly the undesired conditions that you want because you don't understand the culture. And I'm not claiming to be a China expert at all, but I think it's fair to say human nature is what it is. And we need to be careful about China in that regards, because if I was Chinese, I'd have a few chips on my shoulder too.
Oh yeah, I'd be pretty much max grudged if I look back at the history of what all the great things the West has done for China and some of their neighbors. I mean, I don't think if I were Chinese, I'd be too thrilled with the Japanese and some other folks. I mean, some of the less lesser countries like the Philippines haven't done anything in a while to offend the Chinese, I wouldn't think. But a few months ago, I had an old video of like the river operations in China. And they had these. It just really struck me. And one of the scenes in the movie was a ship being hauled up river through. I can't remember if it was through a lock or what. But that there are hundreds of Chinese guys pulling on a rope to bring this thing up the river. And I'm thinking, in the U.S. we would have put a machine in, just like kind of Panama Canal sort of thing, to drag things up through that point. But the Chinese always had these people. And at one point, one of those workers pulling that rope looks at the camera, and I look in his eyes, and I go, ooh. He's not a happy camper. But,
yep, I think I've seen that video. And, people forget, it takes a hard heart to kill tens of millions of your own citizens, which China has done in living memory. And when you think about it, all those people who were executed or starved to death, they've got brothers, uncles, neighbors. I mean, that memory is there. And it's a different people And they're a lot harder than we give them credit for. You know, it's easy to kind of poo-poo some of their technology, but there's one thing that you don't want to do is you really don't want to get into a scrap with them. We learned that in Korea. You know, when somebody is more than happy to lose 100 of their people to every one of yours, that's hard to push.
Well, they can always throw more bodies at it. I mean, if you read my hand, and you realize that the Chinese are taking him very seriously. Then you have to go back and kind of rethink. What if they really follow up on this stuff and they do, and what are we going to do? Again, it's the worst case scenario, but you can't just say, well, we're their biggest trading partner, because that may not, at some point, that may not make a difference. And your discussion earlier about their demographics and trying to keep people happy, there may be some point when we've seen this in other countries in the past, in history of the world, that the easiest way to focus on blaming somebody for what's happening to your country is to point the finger outside.
Bingo. And what do they do? And this is where the danger comes in. And what do they do if they take that path that's happened so many times before about externalizing their national frustration and their internal issues? The first place they'd want to reach out is going to be Taiwan. They always have the Vietnamese border issue. I think probably the second or third play down the road, but who knows, it's going to be the whole Eastern Russia issue. They already have a demographic issue with illegal aliens in the Eastern Siberian area. What happens in 20 or 30 years if the Russians decide that's enough and start to ethnically cleanse that area after they've been there for a couple of generations? How does China respond to that? And we're not even touching on the Indian issue. So there are plenty of points along the Chinese periphery that they can decide that they want to go kinetic. Now, which of those would involve the U.S. military? I think that depends upon who's in the front office, who's the president of the U.S.
Well, I guess the good news for us is that we'll have plenty of discussion points over the – should we do the show for another 4 years? I don't think we'll ever finish completely talking about the topic.
No, because it changes so much. Golly, we're almost done with the hour. I guess one of the things for 2014, at least for our listeners, I would offer is if there is a guest you wish we had, send me an email. Send Eagle1 an email. Let one of us know what that is. If you have an email or a phone number for them, we would love to steal your ideas for guests. Send them our way. We'll talk to almost anybody if they seem interesting to us. But we're not interested in them. Sorry, you're out of luck. But that's what I would offer for 2014. I know we got a lot of regulars and that probably wish we had interviewed one or two people. I'd love to have Robert Gates on. I'm actually going to try to see if I can find a point of contact, because you never know. Hell, we can get Rumsfeld. Why can't we get Gates? Everybody's got a book to
sell. Yeah, he's got a book to sell. So,
how about you, Eagle One? What are you thinking for the new year?
I think we need to do. I think that we've got so many issues going on. I think the non-state actors and the weapon systems they can acquire. We haven't even really discussed marine terrorism in a few years. There's all the issues on EMP. There are issues on the drones. There are issues on the way we are configuring our Navy and whether or not we actually have a naval strategy and whether or not there are any naval strategists. So, I mean, these are all topics that we really need to take a hard look at and would be fun to discuss over the next year.
Who are the naval strategists? That would be a good show. We need to find the right guest for that. But, hey, we're running short of time.
If we could find the right guest, we'd answer the question.
There we go. Solve all the world's problems. But I appreciate everybody who joined us live here for our fourth anniversary chat fest, free for all. As usual, everybody is very shy of the phone. That's okay. We don't take very many callers during the year. And I just thought to take an opportunity to say, Eagle One, you're a great co-host, and I look forward to the next show with you.
Thank you, Sal. I've enjoyed it, and as you and I have discussed before, if we didn't enjoy it, we wouldn't do it. But we thank everybody for showing up. And go ahead.
Yes. And, hey, now we're on the post hour, so those that are joining us via the archive, thank you very much. Send us your ideas for shows if you got some, and until then, have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Bye.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go.
Goodbye, Piccadilly.